legal rights.
This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about businesses and young businesses. We're going to be talking about issues of brand development and expansion for products and services. For those of you who are in businesses, young businesses, and you're looking to expand, this is your program. If you're thinking about possibly buying in as a franchisee with a franchisor, this would be your program, at least to keep your ears open. My guests are Dawn Newton. She's a partner in the San Francisco Bay Area law firm of Donahue Fitzgerald, the Oakland office. Jeffrey Fillerup, a member of the international law firm of McKenna Long and Aldrich, the San Francisco office. Both guests are certified specialists in franchise and distribution law with the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. And Jeff is the chair and Dawn is the vice chair of the commission that oversees franchise and distribution specialization in California. So they're pretty heavyweights here. So if you have questions, hopefully they will have an answer for you. This segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, which certifies 11 fields of law, not only franchise and distribution law, but appellate law, bankruptcy law, criminal law, estate planning, trust and probate law, family law, immigration and nationality law, taxation law, workers' compensation law, legal malpractice law, and maritime law. Additional funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Dawn and Jeff, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
It's lovely to have you here.
Thanks for inviting us.
What if you are an owner of a small restaurant, you're being very successful, and you're thinking, maybe foolishly, about expanding and going and getting another location and having a second restaurant, or maybe the third or fourth or whatever. Dawn, what comments do you have on this? What considerations should someone be making, whether it's a restaurant or whether it's in the retail business or whatever?
There are a lot of different considerations, among which the most important are whether or not you want to expand into a second or third or fourth location by owning that business yourself. And that's not a franchise concept. That's simply expansion by operating that business the same as you operate the existing ones you already own. Or whether you want to explore franchising, where you are extending a license to a third party to operate a business that mimics the one you've already developed. And you have to trust that that person will operate it as well and as faithful to your brand as the one that you've already developed. You also have to comply with an enormous number of disclosure requirements and registration requirements in the state of California and across the rest of the country in order to sell that investment opportunity to the prospective franchisee who you hope will take over that new restaurant location and support your brand.
Why would, tell us this if you would, if someone has, let's say, a successful restaurant, as an example, and however sees the opportunity for being involved with a much larger operation of other restaurants, that maybe is a chain. Why would someone want to become a franchisee in that type of situation? If that is this a common thing that happens, or am I just throwing something out that really is not really relevant?
No, it's a very common thing that happens. We see a lot of people thinking about becoming a franchisee as like buying a business in a box. That's a phrase that we hear a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's appealing to people who have an entrepreneurial spirit but don't want to take all of the risks of coming up with a concept that is completely unique and might fail. The hope with buying a franchise from an existing franchisor is that you've seen that the system and the brand works already. It's been tested.
Such as McDonald's.
You can
for
think
example.
Of it, such as McDonald's. People want to buy a McDonald's because they know that McDonald's has enormous brand success. They know that if they open up a location, they are likely to have a lot of consumers who have such confidence in that brand that they will come and immediately become customers of that new restaurant location.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, if you have a much smaller business, it's a little bit more challenging because although you may have kind of a cult following for that one location or two locations, you don't have that same strength of brand across a giant metropolitan area.
In some other city, for example.
In some other city, exactly. And so the franchisee who's thinking about buying into that much smaller business franchise has to have a higher level of confidence that there's a strong brand, a strong concept and system behind it, so that they know their brand and their new business is likely to be successful and not likely to succumb to being viewed by consumers in their geographic area as no different than any other restaurant.
What generally, if there is a range of percentage, if someone as a franchisee wants to get involved with a franchisor, such as McDonald's, for example, What kind of range of percentage is it that the franchisee, the small business person who wants to become another McDonald's, what kind of percentage does that person have to pay to the franchisor, which is McDonald's, the big corporation?
So let's, as a preliminary thing, I want to make sure before I get a phone call from McDonald's legal counsel, I don't represent anyone having to do with the McDonald's brand. And that's just a good example of franchising.
That's all
it's
I've
very,
done. Yeah.
Very familiar to people.
Okay.
Depending on the type of franchise that you're buying into, the percentage that you have to pay can vary enormously. In the restaurant industry, I tend to see a lot of those royalty percentages hovering around the 4 to 5% mark.
Oh, mm-hmm.
In completely different industries.
4 to 5% of the gross.
4 to 5% of the gross.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on an ongoing basis.
I see.
Mm-hmm. In addition, most of the time, for most franchise systems, you also have to pay an initial fee. And that's just a flat amount that you pay to the franchisor for the privilege of getting into the system.
And that could be substantial in terms of thousands of dollars.
It's often $40,000 or $50,000.
I see. Okay.
And something that's very important, Chuck, is when someone is looking at a franchise and thinking that they want to become a franchisee, they're provided with hundreds of pages of documents to look at. And it can get very complicated. And we talk about this royalty provision, which is just part of all of this paperwork. But this prospective franchisee really has to go through or get some help from an accountant or lawyer and go through mm-hmm. and determine exactly how much they're going to pay. Because really, every system is different. And every system defines gross revenue differently. Every system defines the percentage that has to be paid differently. And so one of the really important tasks, one of the most important things to do when you're looking at a system, a franchise system, and deciding whether you want to become a franchisee or not, is to determine how that royalty is determined and have your accountant look at it mm-hmm. to make sure that it's something that's mm-hmm. going to be a profitable business mm-hmm. for you.
Well, one of the things that I have seen over the years is people get the idea that they'd like to set up, using the restaurant as an example, set up a restaurant and maybe they'll be there and maybe they're not part of a chain. Not part of like a McDonald's chain, but they set up a restaurant and they're hoping it's going to be successful. They may be okay initially, but then something happens and they can't continue the business. Is someone like that who initially is not looking at becoming a part of the big franchise operation? Would it be wise for someone like that to contact a specialist such as yourselves to sit down and talk about What are the positives? What are the negatives of me? I really have almost, I've been an employee of a restaurant for a while. I know how it works. I really want to have my own. Would it be wise for someone like that to come to a certified specialist in franchise and distribution law, or how, what would you suggest to, like that? May I ask you that, Jeff?
Sure. It really depends on the person.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's someone who is experienced in business, is someone who's experienced in dealing with business contracts, mm-hmm. and someone who feels comfortable in going over contracts, it may not be necessary for someone like that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people don't fall in that category, and a lot of people are intimidated by hundreds of pages of single-spaced legal writing. And really, that's what you get when you're a prospective franchisee. And if you're in that category of someone who is uncomfortable with that, who doesn't have experience with that, then I think you definitely need some help.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be from an accountant, or you may need a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're dealing with a lawyer, it would help to have a lawyer who has experience doing that. And in California, that would be a franchise distribution legal specialist. So I think it really depends on the level of experience and expertise and comfort level that the particular potential franchisee has.
Well, let me ask you this. Problems between franchisors and franchisees. What are some of the problems that come up with some frequency, Jeff?
Well, that really ties in to that same topic, because once a person or a company becomes a franchisee, they are their relationship with the franchisor is governed by a franchise agreement. Typically, that franchise agreement is a 50-page, single-spaced contract. It's very detailed. And everything that franchisee is obligated to do, everything the franchisor is obligated to do, is set forth in that contract. And so problems arise oftentimes because the franchisee at the outset didn't go through and really understand all the obligations that he or she has and all of the obligations that the franchisor has. And so they start the business and then they have surprises.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have
mm-hmm.
surprises because they didn't understand exactly what the relationship was at the outset. And that's why it's so important, before you even sign on the dotted line, to really go through and understand what your obligations are. What is this franchisor going to do for me
mm-hmm.
when I pay that royalty every month to them? And so
let me add one more thing. I think one of the things that I do in talking to clients who come to me and say, I'm thinking about buying this franchise opportunity, can you help me evaluate it or perhaps help me negotiate with the franchisor? One of the things that I try to do with them is to brainstorm not only what are the rights and obligations that are, you know, on paper, but how many rights does the franchisor have in the future to change things,
mm-hmm.
change aspects
mm-hmm.
of the system? And Jeff, I suspect you'd probably agree with me that those changes that can pop up in the future are sometimes the ones that create the most friction.
Do you find in your respective practices that it is fairly usual that and now I'm focusing, of course, on someone who wants to be involved as a franchisee. Do you find that it is fairly common for people who want to do that when you've got 50 pages, single space type, to read of this franchise agreement? Do you find that people generally don't even read every page?
That is very common, and that is typically one of the things that creates a dispute between mm-hmm. the franchisor and franchisee. Is the franchisee did not understand exactly what his or her obligations were. and then they get into the relationship, find out that there are problems, there are things that they didn't understand, didn't know were going to happen, and that creates friction. Mm-hmm. And sometimes mm-hmm. it creates a dispute. Oftentimes, as Don mentioned, things change, and the franchisor may change things mm-hmm. In the middle of the franchise relationship. That creates friction. Oftentimes, as we had referred to earlier, there are problems with how you calculate that royalty. It sounds so simple. You know, you take the gross sales, multiply it by a percentage. It sounds so easy, but disputes come up all the time, and there are fights between franchisees and franchisors over how you compute that, and do you include returns in gross sales, there are all kinds of issues, and so yeah. That's why it's so important for the franchisee to sit down with his or her lawyer or accountant up front and mm-hmm. and go through all of that and understand it. Mm-hmm. And I think that the franchisee will end up having a much better relationship with the franchisor if they do that.
Do you have in your practices frequently issues involving trademarks or trade secrets?
Yes.
And would you define very briefly what both of those are, a trademark and a trade secret? And then I'd like you to expound on that just a little bit more.
Sure. So a trade secret is anything that is valuable to your business that is not publicly known. So a trade secret can be almost anything.
It could be a customer list that is not made public. Is that what you're saying?
It could be a customer list. The recipe for Coca-Cola is a very famous trade secret. You know, everyone knows you can buy a bottle of Coca-Cola and look at the ingredients. You know what's in there, but you don't know the exact formula for making it taste the way that it tastes. Any aspect of how you run your business, in some cases, the vendors or the unique relationship that you have with them and the pricing that that you've negotiated, if it's not publicly known, that could be a trade secret.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm.
So a trademark is a source indicator. What that means is it is the word or the image or sometimes even the sound or the color that your customers associate with your business.
For example, In-N-Out Burger, when you see that sign, would that be a trademark?
That's a trademark. Mm-hmm. So the names of most of the famous businesses that you can think of mm-hmm. are all trademarks.
Apple, for example.
Apple is a trademark. Mm-hmm. NBC has those distinctive chimes. That's a sound mm-hmm. that's a trademark.
Is it?
People hear that sound, and you don't have to be looking at the television, but you hear that bong, 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 and you immediately know what television station you're tuned to.
Yeah.
The key with a trademark is it has to be non-functional. But as long as it's non-functional and it tells you who's the source, it's a trademark.
When you say non-functional, give us a simple example of what functional is.
So we're taking a bit of a deep dive here. We'll try not to get too off track. But if you've got something that is useful in some way, it's functional. Mm-hmm. And let me give you an example in the trademark world. I believe it was Dippin' Dots, those little astronaut ice cream things that you can buy that are a food. Mm. They're handfuls of these little frozen ice cream things, and they're confetti colors.
Mm.
And they sought trademark protection for the different colors that were associated with that food.
Wow.
But the problem was that they had made pink the strawberry flavor and green the mint flavor and brown the chocolate flavor. And the response to that was, these are functional colors. They tell the person who's eating them what flavor to expect.
I see.
That's not a trademark.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. Well, what I want to do is I want to give the audience a chance to talk with you, ask questions, and so we're going to take a very brief break. I want to give you the phone number here. And by the way, if you are a business person, whether you're dealing with franchise or distribution, and you have some question in If you have some problem with your business, with somebody else or whatever, we'll talk about this in a minute with Jeff, but he does a lot of business litigation. So we can go beyond franchise and distribution if you have a question like that. So here's the number. 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. If you'd like to call in with your question, your comment, your problem, whatever, please do. All right. It's Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about, at least initially, issues of brand development and expansion for products and services in the area of franchise and distribution law. My guests are... Jeff Fillerup is the chair, and Don Newton is the vice chair of the Commission on Franchise and Distribution Law of the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. And so they're very experienced in this. To be a certified specialist, they've jumped over a number, or they've had to throw the basketball in a number of hoops, take another bar exam and take several years and have a lot of people say that, yes, they should be a certified specialist. So this is not a simple thing to be a certified specialist. So if you have a question or comment or whatever, please join us. But what I want to ask you, Jeff, what is, now you do a lot of litigation in the area of franchise and distribution law, but you also go beyond just franchise and distribution law and are involved with more general business litigation. Can you give us an example or two of what your practice involves?
Sure. And I am something that we in the legal business call a business litigator. Mm-hmm. Which is a lawyer that deals with disputes between businesses. And they arise in a lot of different instances. Here in San Francisco, it's very common because there's so much office space for businesses who are tenants of office buildings to have disputes with the building owner. Mm-hmm. That's a very common kind of business litigation. We had mentioned earlier trademarks and trade secrets, so it's very common for business litigators to become involved in disputes between businesses involving infringement of trademarks, mm-hmm. misappropriation of trade secrets, infringement of patents, mm-hmm. and that's called intellectual property litigation, which is a subset of business litigation. One of the things I do frequently is investors frequently get together and invest in projects. And oftentimes those investors have disputes. It's very common, and I've handled a number of disputes between investors and businesses. So those are the kinds of things that business litigators handle.
Something that comes up with some frequency, unfortunately, but you can't avoid it. All right, let's start with Pepper. Pepper, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you. I'm devising a course that uses normal language, and I'm just wondering about how I can protect the name of the course.
Oh, that's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, so Pepper, it sounds like the name of the course would probably be a trademark if you're going to use it as the name for a series of courses or as the name of the business that is selling the course. And
I have the name of my business is Berkeley Mediation, so it wouldn't be the same.
Okay. But you would be using the specific name for this course, you would be using as to the public, you would be holding it out as the name that people would associate with. Is it a series of courses or is it just a one-time course?
It's a six-week course.
Okay. And do you plan to offer that a number of times? So
yes.
6 weeks? Okay. So probably you could get that qualified as a trademark. And if you're planning to use this course and sell it over a period of years and you think that someone else might want to use that same name, it probably makes sense for you to look into trademarking it with the United States Patent and Trademark Office.
Is that an expensive and a lengthy process, or is it quick, and is it Inexpensive, I hope.
It can be inexpensive, but it is not quick.
Okay.
There, you can go to see an attorney. I do trademark registrations all the time, but there are also some commercial services that provide trademark registration. They tend to not provide the same level of searching and legal advice as you would get if you saw an attorney, but there are, if you search online for register trademarks, you can find some sources that get down into only a couple of $100 for the fees, and you'll pay a $325 filing fee to the Patent and Trademark Office. But
okay.
you can expect it to take 9 months or more from the time that you file.
Dawn, if Pepper doesn't want to pay the cost and go to the trouble of getting a trademark with the Patent and Trademark Office, does she have some other options that she could pursue to try to protect that name without getting a trademark?
You do. Under the common law in the United States, just using a trademark, using a name that is associated with your goods or services, gives you a certain number of rights if someone comes in and infringes. But those rights are more limited if you don't get the registration.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, they're limited to the geographic area in which you're actively using that mark.
Pepper, if I can ask you again, you mentioned something, Berkeley something. What did you say?
Well, my business as a sole proprietor is Berkeley Mediation, but that's not the name of the court.
Yeah, okay, all right. So you're doing mediation over in the Berkeley area, and you want to name it a particular name that hopefully will be identified by people and they will contact you. Obviously, let me throw this one to you, Dawn. If Pepper had wanted to use the words as the name of her business, Berkeley Mediation, would she have any basis at all for trademark on that?
That's a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
When you have a name that is very descriptive, it is not ordinarily trademarkable, registrable as a trademark until it's achieved distinctiveness. And achieving distinctiveness means, in the eyes of your general public, your consumer group, do they associate that with your business specifically, or do they just hear it as a description of the type of business? When you think about a supermarket or a grocery store, we think about that as a generic name, not as a specific company.
We have come to the end of the statewide version of the program. Stay with us for a moment, would you, Pepper? All right. It is about 7:28 at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. And we are doing a program on business issues, brand development, expansion of products and services, franchise and distribution law. If you have a question in the area of businesses, problems that you may be confronted with, beyond even being a franchisor or a franchisee, please feel comfortable in calling in. The number is 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. My guests are both certified specialists in franchise and distribution law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Jeff Fillerup is the chair of the commission of that specialty, and Dawn Newton is the vice chair of that specialty. And the commission and the Board of Legal Specialization oversees and makes sure that the specialists are complying with the law and doing what they're supposed to do. It is not a simple matter to become a certified specialist. If you've been listening to this program over the years, I think you know that there are a lot of things that one needs to do to become a certified specialist. So if you'd like to call in with your question, your comment, your concern, whether it's franchise and distribution or you have a business litigation issue or just a plain business issue, the number is 1-415-841-4134. Before we take, and by the way, let me come back to you, Pepper. Did you have any other question or any other thought that you wanted to present?
I had one other quick question,
sure.
And then I'll take that question's answer off the air.
Sure.
You mentioned local area. In the local area, if I'm doing this, also offering this course by Skype, then how does that relate? And I'll take my question off the air.
So
thanks. Thank you, Pepper, for calling.
In a situation where you're offering this by Skype, and you might
for those of us who don't know what Skype is, what is Skype?
So Skype is a way to connect via video with other people who may be anywhere. It's like telephone, mm-hmm. but with a video component.
Okay, all right.
So if you're offering the course via Skype, it's essentially like offering the course to people who may be in many different states, potentially even different countries, but given the name of Pepper's business, I'm assuming that she's dealing with people in the U.S. who mm-hmm. are concerned about U.S. law or U.S. issues. That in that instance, you would be more concerned about getting federal protection because you may be offering it to a very wide group of people. If you don't take the step of getting the federal registration, then if someone were to challenge your rights in that mark, you might have to go back and recreate the areas into which you had actively sold that course.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that can be somewhat complicated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me just mention something to you. Coming up, and it's going to be actually next week on Friday, August 15th, the San Mateo County Law Library will have a presentation on senior citizens, how to avoid scams. And attorney, pardon me, Jay White, we'll discuss what you need to know to avoid scams and what to do if you or someone you know has fallen prey to one. You are invited to come to the San Mateo County Law Library at noon, and it's right across the street from the Hall of Justice in Redwood City. Bring your sack lunch if you like. It'll be about an hour presentation. It's a free presentation. This is something that the Law Library does on a monthly basis along with other presentations. And the Law Library is at 710 Hamilton Street in downtown Redwood City. If you'd like some more information on this, the number for the library is 650-363-4913, 650-363-4913. Now, what I want to do is encourage all of you who may be business owners, small business owners, maybe medium-sized business owners, maybe you work for a business. I'm not asking you to ask questions about employment law, whether you as an employee are entitled to this or that, wages, et cetera, et cetera. We will be doing that at the end of this month, by the way, on hours and breaks and that kind of stuff. But if you have a question about businesses, something that's been bugging you, whether you're an employee or an employer, with regard to how the business is operated, or you've got a problem with someone else who's competing with you, I welcome you to call in and ask the question, make a comment, and let's see what kind of a response you can get. Again, 1-415-841-4134. This is a little bit different topic that we don't do franchise and distribution law actually that often, and so it's a little bit unusual. But I want to encourage those of you who, let's say, have businesses, small businesses, or maybe even better than a small business, larger than small businesses, to feel comfortable to call in. So I leave it to you. All right. What have we... one of the things that I know you wanted to talk about with regard to franchise and franchisee, franchise and distribution law, is what if someone is a franchisee of a chain and has been with this chain for a while, whatever it may be, whether it's a restaurant or maybe it's some kind of retail outfit, and has an idea of an innovation that might actually be very, this franchisee believes, very productive, not only for this franchisee's business, but maybe for the overall franchise as a whole. What are the difficulties there, Dawn, if someone has an idea for an innovation, an innovative product or service, and the franchisor has a set way of looking at things?
Well, I would say, and I'll editorialize for a minute here, in a well-run franchise system, you're not going to have problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the most successful franchise systems get to where they are in part by listening to and partnering with their franchisees. I believe in the Subway system was actually a franchisee who came up with the $5 footlong that was such a big hit, particularly during the recent recession. And these kinds of things that can really change the face of a franchise system in terms of bringing a new product to the market or bringing a new service to the market often come from innovations from the people who are the boots on the ground those systems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly there are problems, and Jeff probably sees them as often as I do, with systems that are a little too rigid and they don't want to consider innovations or new thoughts from franchisees. There can be some valid reasons to discard something that a particular franchisee might want to do that's simply not scalable or doesn't fit well with the brand. But I think it makes good sense for most franchisors to listen.
Jeff, if for example, and my understanding from what you've told us in the earlier part of the program is that the franchise agreement, of course, is something that the franchisor, the big corporation, has put together. It sounds like it's not something that a franchisee or someone who wants to become a franchisee has much bargaining power to change. Either you accept it as a franchisee or you don't. What if, but my understanding from what you've said is that the franchisor in the agreement has the right to change certain provisions in the agreement at the franchisor's whim. Is that true, Don, basically?
It depends on how the franchise agreement is written, but a very common way that franchise agreements are written is to provide that certain things are fixed. The royalties may be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
The amount that a franchisee has to pay for marketing fund contributions and certain other technology rights are fixed. But then there's a big category of system compliance that's typically written into what the most franchisors call an operations manual. And the franchisor will say, we reserve the right to change the operations manual as we see fit, and you are required to continuously comply with whatever is in the operations manual. What that means is they can change a certain amount of what's going on in the system in a pretty fluid way, and you have to comply with that.
And that's a prime area of dispute, because oftentimes the franchisor will change the operations manual. It negatively affects the revenue of the franchisee, and the franchisee then says, no, you can't do that to me.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't in the franchise agreement, and you just can't change the operations manual to affect my revenue. So that's a prime area of dispute between franchisors and franchisees.
Can that generally be resolved without a lawsuit, or what normally happens in a situation like that?
Well, whenever there's a dispute between a franchisor and franchisee, and let's just use that as an example, the franchisor changes the operations manual, the franchisee says, no, you can't do that, that's going to negatively affect my income, then the first step is the franchisor and the franchisee talk about it, see if they can get it resolved. Oftentimes, the franchise agreement will have a mandatory mediation provision, and the franchisor and franchisee have to go through a formal mediation session to try to get it resolved. After that, there's probably an arbitration provision, and so the dispute goes to arbitration for a final resolution. So the dispute really never goes to court, but and still, even though it doesn't go to court and doesn't have to go to a trial in court, it can still be an expensive process for the franchisee to go through the initial meetings, then the mediation process, and then an arbitration. That can end up being almost as expensive as a lawsuit.
I take it then, and I'm assuming probably in most franchise agreements that a provision for mediation and another provision for arbitration is generally the way that these agreements are set up.
That's right.
So you as a prospective franchisee, when you take a look at the proposed a franchise agreement and see that there's a mediation provision, there's an arbitration provision, you as a prospective franchisee do not have any power or negotiation ability to say, well, no, I don't want to end up by going to arbitration. I want to have an agreement that this can go to trial before a jury. I take it that they're not going to get anywhere with that.
You're really asking a broader question, and that is the franchisor willing to negotiate the terms of the franchise agreement?
Yes.
And I think you're correct in that typically the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
There may be some small franchisors, some new franchisors that are agreeable to some negotiation, but typically it's very hard to negotiate away or come up with new terms in the franchise agreement. And so typically, if you see in that franchise agreement there's mandatory mediation and mandatory arbitration and no jury trial, that's going to be hard to change that.
And let me add one more thing. I completely agree with Jeff. There are certain terms that franchisors almost never negotiate on. The amount of the royalty that they're going to take, the dispute resolution provisions, indemnity requirements, they may be more willing, even some of the more mid-sized franchisors may be more willing to negotiate a few smaller provisions, like whether or not you have the right to assign your franchise to family members without having to pay a transfer fee.
I see.
There can be small nuanced things that they are willing to negotiate, and they will tell you in their sales presentations, well, of course we'll negotiate with you.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to these kinds of very core concepts, the answer is almost always no.
All right. Here's something that was brought into the studio. And by the way, I want to encourage you, if you are a business owner or a prospective business owner, please feel free to call in with your question or your concern or the problem that you may be faced with right now. It's 1-415-841-4134 on Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. My guests are certified specialists in franchise and distribution law, Don Newton and Jeff Fillerup. And here's something that was brought into the studio. I've heard that a big percentage of new businesses fail in their first year. Do new franchises tend to have a better success rate than other businesses, a better survival rate?
I don't know the percentages. So I can't speak with authority to the percentage of franchises that fail. But my general understanding is that there is a higher success rate for franchises, but there are certainly high numbers of franchises that also fail.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the danger areas that I see with franchisees who sometimes come in to talk to me is an optimism that they have seen this beautiful sales presentation. And the way that most franchises are sold is there's what's called a discovery day, where the prospective franchisees get brought in to meet with all of the salespeople and the core business people involved with that franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very positive, uplifting, encouraging sales presentation, which is another reason why we talked at the top of the show about how people don't tend to read the disclosure packet that they get. It's because they get the sales presentation. And you get people who are so euphoric about the prospect that they don't dig into some of the dangers and the red flags. And there are lots of reasons why, even in a successful business, you might end up with the wrong combination of factors, including, for example, a prospective franchisee who's just not well suited to meet all of the demands of running a particular type of business, or a business that's not well suited to go into a particular geographic area.
How do you determine that, though? How does one who is a prospective franchisee determine whether or not I am suited for this particular type of business or this particular area where I'd like to establish this franchise business wouldn't be good? How does one who doesn't have this wealth of experience determine that?
It's more art than science.
Okay.
But
all right.
I will tell you, when I sit down with someone to talk to them about the prospect of whether or not they want to buy a particular franchise, and I do this the same way when I'm talking to my franchisor clients about their evaluation of a prospective franchisee who's come to them. Are they the right fit? I see a lot of people who fall in love with the idea of a business. They want to go buy a framing gallery business because they like art.
Yes.
Or they want to buy a business that has to do with pets because they love pets. Well, the reality of running any one of these types of franchise businesses is that you're going to spend the majority of your time ordering new supplies and dealing with bookkeeping and dealing with managing your employees and potentially negotiating your lease and dozens of other general business things that don't have to do with the theme of the business that you're in. But there are other challenges, like if you're going to be a restaurateur, you need to really be quick on your feet and understand the challenges that running a restaurant faces. If you spend too much time thinking about how beautiful your business is and not enough time thinking about looking at the franchise document, as Jeff was describing, getting into the nuances and understanding, are you really equipped to do all the things you're required to do, you're potentially going to fail.
Well, that's okay. That's a very good advice. One needs to be very, very cautious. Again, the number 1-415-841-4134. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own at 650-369-4149. 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a Bar Association lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. You should be able to get a human being on the other end of the phone, and they'll do their best to get somebody who's experienced in your area. And for a half an hour consultation, pretty much statewide, it'll be something like between $25 to $35. Now, if you're interested in trying to find a certified specialist in whether it's franchise and distribution or whether it's in any of the other 11 certified specialties, I'll give you a couple of pieces of information that you may want to jot down. The statewide number is 415-538-2100. 415-538-2100. Or you can go to the internet, and that's www.calbar.ca.gov. Go to the left side of the screen for legal specialists. Whether you're calling the statewide number, the 415 number, or going to the internet, you will be able to find out from either source who the certified specialists are in your geographical area in the state of California. And you'll be able to then find out who these people are, the phone number, make some calls, ask some questions, and that's how you can find a certified specialist. All right. We have, if I pronounce this correctly, I hope, Curran. Is that the correct pronunciation of your name?
That's correct.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I understand you're talking about the business. So I have, nowadays, the new culture is about, having virtual offices and starting off new businesses and online and things like that. So I have a few questions. So what kind of challenges do you see from that side? And now, how do you also see any sort of controversies or things happening from a legal perspective where two businesses are almost same, but they try to compete? Do you see any sort of challenges from that perspective?
Well, let's take the second question first. If you've got two businesses that are almost the same but are competing, as long as neither one is using the trade secrets of the other that it acquired improperly, or otherwise engaging in what we call unfair business practices, which is really overreaching. If it's just two businesses that happen to share a lot of the same attributes, they're allowed to compete, and there's no restriction on the two of them competing. And you see this a lot if you think about, for example, hot dog restaurants or burger chains. You can look at those and see that they're selling, in many cases, almost the same menu. They're set up almost the same way. They have the same ingredients. They may buy from the same vendors. There's no restriction on that.
Okay. So now extending the same concept from a software perspective, since my line is from a software perspective, say, is there any geographical boundaries that are restricting any of these rules?
So when you say from a software perspective, are you saying that if you're going to have virtual offices and you're extending some kind of software to help organize that, are there any geographic boundaries there?
Yes. Say, for example, if I start a office and I have a franchise in, say, Europe as well as in India, and now there is an equivalent company, but they don't have any franchise anywhere else, but they have, say, just in Europe alone. So is there some kind of, legal rights that protect us? From developing the same software, or they take the same idea and they start developing out there in the Europe.
So you've wrapped a lot of concepts together. When you talk about developing ideas, ordinarily an idea itself is not protectable. If it's a secret idea, something that people don't know about, it's a trade secret, and you can, as long as you put non-disclosure agreements in place with anyone you share it with and you otherwise keep it secret, no one else has a right to use it. They're not allowed to break into your office, learn about it, and then use it. That would be misappropriation.
Gotcha.
But
okay.
If it's a publicly known idea, the idea for having virtual offices or the idea that a software does a particular thing, anyone who can create their own iteration of it ordinarily is allowed to do that. The one limitation on that is if you have a patent for the novel and innovative technology or idea that goes into that software, you may be able to prevent someone from duplicating that software function with a patent. Assuming you don't have a patent in place, then probably, as long as you're not using someone else's trademark, so a company in England that has a trademark, you wouldn't be able to necessarily borrow that trademark and create a business that's identical to it in another country without that company likely having, depending on the different international laws that come into play, likely having some objection to it that's valid. But if you're just talking about can you create a business that's similar to another business, as long as you're doing it in a completely lawful way, you can do that, but you probably want to talk to a lawyer.
Who should Kern at this type? You have you've got the desire to create this. Is that right, Kern? It doesn't exist yet?
No, I'm trying to create a new concept. And
okay, all right. Let me interrupt.
What if I'm in the process and I've also patented it and now?
Oh, you do have a patent. Okay.
Like say for example, I just applied today, and then in Europe, the same kind of concept, someone else designs it, and they also apply same today itself.
Have you yet, Kiran, conferred with an attorney on any of these issues?
No, I'm yet
okay.
to.
Let me ask.
I've already done my case studies and trials.
Let me get some input for you with respect to what my guests think you should do now with regard to the next step for you in trying to protect yourself and develop something that you hopefully will be able to call your own. So if you'll take the balance of the answer on the air, if you'll turn your radio back up, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you so much.
What comments do you have for him now? He says he has applied for a patent, et cetera. What should he do now as obviously someone who has apparently an idea that I'm going to create this terrific type of international business. That's what it sounds like to me. What thoughts do you have, Dawn?
Well, I don't think that Jeff holds himself out as a patent attorney, and I certainly don't hold myself out as a patent attorney. So to the extent that he's got a patent application that he filed today, there are certainly a lot of questions that he should have for someone who practices in the area of patent about where the geographic boundaries of that patent protection are, whether if he's thinking about going into Europe or if there's another company in Europe, if he should file a patent in the EU, or if he should examine a patent that another company, this other competitor, might have filed in the EU that might interfere with his expansion into that territory. Those are certainly some steps that I would take. And if I were advising him outside of the patent realm, I would be looking very closely at what is the other business, how far down the line in terms of its establishment, and all of the aspects that go into its trade dress, its trademarks, what kind of advertising it's doing. Mm-hmm. How closely does that look and feel like his business to try to avoid in every instance an accusation from that other company, which may be more well-established than his is, that he's actually copying them in a way that's not permitted. Mm-hmm. And similarly, I would be looking at what trademark filings he can make, what protections he can put in place both here and in the EU and perhaps in other international countries to protect his own footprint for his expanding business.
And what recommendation would you have for someone who obviously it does sound like Curran at this point needs to sit down with an experienced patent attorney? How would you suggest, I don't know where he is, but let's assume he's in San Francisco, calling the lawyer referral service of the San Francisco Bar to start that way, or how would you recommend that what he should do, Jeff?
I think that would be a good way for him to start with the lawyer referral service.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we've heard from the callers is really a basic question, and that is, what should I do to protect my business, and is it worth it for me to go out and spend the money to get a patent or trademark or copyright or trade secret?
Mm-hmm.
And I think every business, particularly every small business, has to address that, and is it really worth it? And I think that's what Pepper is looking at. That's what Kieran is looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these marks are very expensive. And so they have to sit down with a consultant, maybe a lawyer, and talk about how much it will cost and what the benefit will be. Because oftentimes, small businesses don't really look at what the benefit is, and they end up spending too much money getting a trademark when it really doesn't benefit them. And so one of the things I think that both Pepper and Kieran need to look at is this really worth it down the road?
I want to thank both of you very much for joining us on the program. Very nice to have you here. Dawn Newton, who will be the chair in a few months.
Yes, I will.
And Jeffrey Fillerup, the chair right now of the Commission on Franchise and Distribution Law of the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Chuck.
Great to have you here on the program. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr, and production assistant is Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights, this particular session, has been made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Your Legal Rights is also funded by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. If you have been awarded child support, and the other party, the other parent who has been ordered by the court to make the payments, isn't making the payments, we're going to be talking next week about strategies for collecting child support. My guest will be Raymond Goldstein, a family lawyer and vice chair of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California. Thank you very much for listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney.